This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penn-Cava. The inauguration of North Carolina's governor and the Council of State takes place this weekend, but two members of the Council of State will likely not be sworn in, Superintendent for Public Instruction and Agriculture Commissioner. The Ag Commissioner race in particular is the Election Day story that, more than 2 months later, just keeps going. The race for Agriculture Commissioner between Republican Steve Troxler and Democrat Britt Cobb is still being contested, thanks in part to over 4,000 lost ballots in Carteret County. Then, just after 5 o'clock yesterday, Superior Court Judge James Spencer fired the latest shot in this ongoing fight. He ruled that the Board of Elections, the State Board of Elections, could not call for a revote statewide. Well, here to help us understand this recent decision and offer some thoughts on what might happen next is WUNC's Capitol reporter, Laura Leslie. Hi there, Laura.
Hi, Melinda.
Well, as it stands right now, Laura, Steve Troxler leads Britt Cobb, the Democrat, the incumbent, by 2,287 votes. But there are those 4,400-some-odd votes lost on a hard drive in Carteret County. And now we have the judge last night saying you can't have a vote revote statewide. So where do we go from here?
Well, actually, the judge didn't exactly say that they can't have a statewide revote. He actually specifically said he's not ruling on that. Mm-hmm. What he ruled on was the way that the State Board of Elections went about it, which was a little bit of a little bit of parliamentary finessing. Basically, there's five people in the State Board of Elections. Two of them are Republicans, three of them are Democrats. But in order to get a new election called, you got to have four. And they weren't able to come up with four, except for this compromise deal, their first solution. I don't know if you remember, it was a partial special election just in Carteret. Well, a judge threw that out. So when it came back, they said, well, maybe we could just amend it. And you can amend it with three people instead of four. The judge threw it out. He said he called it an end run around the statute. And he said it's just not permissible.
So what options are there now to figure out who won this race?
Well, it's going back to the state board with specific instructions by Judge Spencer, who was the one who made the ruling yesterday, to drop the partisan politics. He says, you know, it's time to come up with an answer to this. It's long past time, and it's time to, you know, let the passion of partisan politics give way to the integrity of the electoral process. Basically, he's telling them to behave themselves and come up with a solution. Mm-hmm. And the solutions that they could come up with include they could just go ahead and certify Steve Troxler as the winner. They could say we need to just poll those 4,438 people again, which is what Troxler would like to do, because the Republican candidate, he's already got the lead. And the way that the vote went in Carteret County was about 60-40. So he's got a pretty reasonable chance at winning if they just repoll those particular people. They could also, and this is one of the ones that, well, they could also call a new statewide election all over again if they could get four votes. But they could also throw it to the state legislature under a clause in the Constitution.
And they're trying to avoid it being political then? Really?
Well, you know, I mean, when you got three and two and nobody's going to budge, then, mm-hmm. you know, your options are limited. They've really run up against that in the last couple of meetings. So, and there is actually a passage in the Constitution. It's under Article 6, Section 5, that says if there's a contested race for a Council of State, that the state legislature gets to decide what the answer is going to be.
And I guess time would tell us whether the legislature can live by what the judge was saying of let's not, you know, not be political about this and let's do the right thing, whatever that might be. Steve Troxler was the Republican said he was ecstatic at the judge's ruling.
He's a happy man.
Yeah. And Britt Cobb, what was his response?
Britt Cobb is not so happy. He would really like to see the state board throw it back to the legislature, I think, because both of the houses, as we've mentioned before, are going to be controlled by his party, by Democrats. Now, that's not a shoo-in, you know. But, you know, barring a statewide election, that would be the next best thing for Britt Cobb. Troxler's happy because if it went statewide, well, number one, it's a $3.5 million proposition, which a lot of people are unhappy about, not just Steve Troxler. But it also would open up the possibility to a Democratic majority actually showing up at the polls and you know, putting Britt Cobb back in office.
Sure. And, of course, we should say that Steve Troxler earlier this week had offered over 1,000 affidavits from voters. They knew whose votes were lost in Carteret County, so they went door to door down in Carteret, and they got affidavits from over 1,000 people who said they had voted for Troxler, and that would have been the majority he needed. Did you think that swayed the judge's decision yesterday, or was he going strictly on the way the Board of Elections decided 3-2 to have a statewide election?
The impression I got from watching the arguments in the courtroom was that not necessarily that the judge thought that that should be that the, you know, that the affidavits should settle it, but it did bring up just one more reminder that there is another way to settle this besides another statewide election. And with that kind of price tag, you know, I think everybody's thinking there's got to be a simpler way to do this. And so what those affidavits actually get 1,300 some affidavits from voters, and they swore in front of a notary that they had voted for Steve Troxler. And you're right. Mathematically, Steve Troxler would win. There wouldn't be enough votes left for Brett Cobb to overcome Troxler's lead. So, you know, what Troxler's saying is, you know, look, I've got the votes locked up. Mm-hmm. So let's just go ahead and declare this thing and move on with it.
Right. And in the meantime, Brett Cobb remains the incumbent, and perhaps this will go through Saturday when everybody else is being inaugurated into the Council of State. Do you have any sense, Laura, you laid out what the possibilities were, when this could be decided?
I was on the phone this morning with the folks at the State Board of Elections. They have not yet set their next meeting date, so nothing's going to happen until they figure out what they want to do with it next. And that could be next week or the week after, depending on how long it takes them to get everybody in a room together.
Okay, I'm sure we'll be talking about it again. Thanks so much, Laura.
You're very welcome.
Laura Leslie covers state politics in Raleigh for WUNC. The latest novel by author Connie Mae Fowler, The Problem with Murmur Lee, begins with the drowning of Murmur Lee. She's 35 years old, the owner of a dive kind of bar on a barrier island in northern Florida. She's fond of reading poetry to the stars and the bobcats and listening to Gillian Welch from the boombox on her old river skiff. But in the opening pages of the book, Murmur Lee dies in a river. How and why someone so connected to the land and the water could drown there is one of the central questions of the novel. And author Connie Mae Fowler is with us in the studio to talk about this and more today. Welcome, Connie Mae.
I'm very, very happy to be here.
Well, Murmur Lee dies early in this book, is, as I mentioned, a bright flash she recalls for us. And then she's in the water and dying. I was going to ask why you'd kill off such a lovable character so early in the novel, but then as you read along, you realize this is what you're after. You're painting a picture not only with her recollections, but those of people she knew.
Yes, I mean, she goes through quite a journey in death, and she's as surprised as everyone else is that she's dead. And so her journey in death is really, she starts to reconcile her family's past and reconcile her own past while the living are still trying to reconcile her death.
Mm-hmm. And you have a number of her friends who tell their stories here and so forth. And what we have is they're uncovering not only why she died, but why she was alone in many parts of her life.
Yes, I think they all use Murmur Lee as to reflect upon their own lives. And there's a lot in the book about the nature of love and the nature of solitude, I think. And certainly when Murmur leaves, they are all feeling the solitude in ways that are very profound.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are a number of characters here. One of them is her childhood friend, Charlie.
Charlie Mudd.
Who, a woman who has gone north to Harvard, dropped out of divinity school, comes back because Murmur Lee is dead. And she's the person who takes care of Murmur Lee's estate, such as it is.
Yes.
Afterward. And I was wondering if you might read a passage for us here. And this is the last will and testament of Murmur Lee. We have part of it here. And in this, we're hearing her voice and probably getting a good glimpse on Murmur Lee early on.
Yes, Murmur, she doesn't know why exactly, but she just decides that it's time for her to write her own will and testament. It's the anniversary of the death of a friend of hers, and so she's in a reflective mood, and so she jots down a will. First, to my ex-husband, Eric Nathanson, father of my child, I bequeath to you Daisy Blue, my 1992 Dodge pickup, which, as of this moment, sports 97,336,000 hard-earned miles. It is my sincere hope that my dear truck will inspire you for once in your life to get those pretty manicured hands dirty. Also, this is what I do not bequeath to you, any portion of the air our child once breathed. I am not a bitter woman, just practical. You don't deserve a single particle of her, no matter how tenuous or spectral the connection might be. The fact that I leave you something at all is a sign that I have, A, successfully purged your negative energy from my personal and spiritual life. It took years of tear spilling and potion rubbing to get to this point, but hey. And B, forgiven your treatment of our daughter and me, although I will never absolve you of the consequences. My rifle. I love that gun. I have aimed her at rattlesnakes, rats, shadows, unwanted solicitors, and old boyfriends who came calling at just the wrong time. She has never let me down. Lest anyone forget, she was given to me on my wedding day by Grandfather Harp. So you, Lucinda, my youngest, meanest, most talented, and much-beloved friend and neighbor, you don't fool me. I know you proclaimed yourself a pacifist and joined the Mennonite Church just to piss me off. The rifle is yours. Be good to her. Keep her cleaned and oiled, and she will see you through many a scrape, nonviolent and otherwise. I hereby donate all my books, with some exclusions which I will note below, to the St. Johns County Homeless Shelter. Mine food is just as important as slopping down a bowl of watery soup. Charlie, call the shelter to arrange for a pickup. No need you hauling all those boxes down the stairs.
That's Connie Mae Fowler reading from her book, The Problem with Murmur Lee. That's part of the will and testament of Murmur Lee, and we will get to more of that story. We're taking your calls, 1-877-962-9862. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. There's some plain song there. You may not think of this when you think of a book that is set in Florida, but it plays very much into the latest book by Connie Mae Fowler. It's called The Problem with Murmur Lee. It begins, as we've said, with the untimely death of this 35-year-old woman in a river in Florida. Connie Mae Fowler is here in the studio, and such music plays into her death.
Yes, it does. Murmur suffers from a very, very rare form of epilepsy called musicogenic epilepsy, and it's a form of tonal epilepsy. And in her case, I mean, people can't hear certain types of music, and in her case, she can't hear Gregorian chant.
Without going into a seizure.
Right. She has seizures when she hears Gregorian chants, which for me, it's just my great private joke. My mother, before she took up with my father, was a nun. She left the convent, and so I grew up at the hands of a former nun. So I think that it's sort of my way to get back at her in some way, that my character dies by Gregorian chant.
Well, I had to go searching on the web. I had to say, is this real, or is this a piece of fiction, musicogenic epilepsy? And it does exist. How did you come upon it?
I wanted her to die in a way that was pretty much untraceable. And so I started doing some research and found out that there are deaths by drowning that really are actually people had epileptic seizures, fell into the water, and that's how they died. And so then I started researching different kinds of epilepsy and came across this, and it was absolutely perfect for my purposes, because I wanted music to play a huge role in the book.
Indeed, and indeed it does. There is another scene in the book that just I had to laugh out loud. Where Murmur has a friend of hers leads Murmur and several friends in yoga.
Yes.
And Murmur insists that the music they're going to play while they're doing yoga is the Allman Brothers.
Yes, she loves the Allman Brothers. And so they're doing yoga to Statesboro Blues. And it's just pretty zany.
Indeed. So how much did you know somebody like Murmur?
I did. In fact, I lived at a place like Iris Haven, where this story is set, and there was a woman there who is still a dear friend of mine, who is very independent, sexually independent, financially independent, built her own house with her own hands, and she was very controversial because of that independence. And so she always fascinated me, and the stories that swirled around her fascinated me. And so there was one story going around about her that was just put her in a terrible light, and I really couldn't believe it. And then out of the blue, she told me the story, Everyone had left out an essential piece of information that changed it completely, and that really haunted me. So that was the seed of that book. And, you know, everyone in town is murmuring, so there goes the name, Murmur Lee. So.
Oh, wonderful. Well, it's a wonderful read, and it's set, as many of your books are, in rural Florida.
Yes.
And this is on a barrier island in the northern part of Florida, near St. Augustine, is
mm-hmm,
that right?
Between St. Augustine and Marineland.
Yeah. And this is a part of the world that has not yet been entirely resorted over, or has it, or is that starting? Is it that kind of encroachment coming on?
Well, Summer Haven is pretty much protected. I mean, it's populated by it almost looks like a New England village, and the houses are very old. They're turn of the century, and I don't think a lot can happen on that barrier island, but certainly all around it, you know, development abounds.
Mm-hmm. You've written a memoir.
Yes.
When Katie wakes, and that's about your own childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And Murmur in this book has a childhood that it's not exactly happy.
Right.
And your own as well.
Yeah, my own was pretty miserable. my family life was very violent. My father was a batterer, and he died when I was really young. And then my mother takes that step that we all hope that women never cross over, but she had no help. And you know, in the 1960s, there were no domestic violence shelters, we didn't even use the term. And so she became a batterer. So she abused my sister and myself and my brother. And so we grew up, you know, on welfare, getting beat up. But, you know, I always had books. They kept me safe and free.
I've read that as a child for years you didn't speak.
I did not.
Writing was your way.
Yes. And I developed a terrible stutter. And so kids just made terrible fun of me. And so I just decided to be quiet. And it was a great thing. It sounds like a bad thing, but it wasn't. We lived in this crazy place called the Traveler's Motel, which was this transient motel, and it was filled with all kinds of people. And so I was a fly on the wall. I could just sit there and listen to all sorts of people. And it was one of the most important things in me becoming a writer because I absorbed their voices.
Mm-hmm. And some of that worked into a book that Oprah Winfrey made into a movie.
Yes, Before Women Had Wings.
Yeah, because there was a black woman at the motel.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who you wrote that this was somebody, you realized that somebody could love you. Unquestioningly.
It was like the first time I'd ever really experienced unconditional love. The first time anybody said, oh, you're such a pretty little girl. You know, the first positive reinforcement I ever received.
Mm-hmm. So you grew up in Florida, and you've been out of the state for some of your schooling, is
yes,
that right?
I went to Kansas, and after my mother died, I dropped out of school and just kind of bandied about the country. I was a waif, a traveling waif, but I returned to Florida.
Right. There's another reading I'd love if you could give us here, and this is a character in the book, Murmur Lee, Problem with Murmur Lee, and it's her friend, Charlie Mudd, who returns because Murmur has died. And Charlie, as we mentioned, has dropped out of divinity school. And she comes back to the town she's from, but she speaks here about what it is to be a Southerner up north.
Yes, and she says that she left the South because she was a self-loathing Southerner, and she tried to become Yankee-fied. So this is her rumination on how it went with her trying to pass as a Yankee. So yes, I could pass as Northern on most days. I learned to make a phone call and get to the point immediately, rather than engage in the ritualized politeness that serves as the glue binding all cultures of the South into one huge dysfunctional gossip tree. You know, how's your daddy, your great-granddaddy, your camellias, and your mama doing? When the point of the call was to ask, can you please turn down your stereo just a tad? The baby's trying to sleep. I could meet a man for the very first time and discuss world issues without knowing who his people were. I could bully my way up to the front of a line without ever once saying, excuse me. I quit addressing people as sir or ma'am, even if they were over 70. This alone would have killed my mother had she been alive. I ate grits only in private. A store in St. Augustine shipped them to me. I hid them in a tin canister I kept tucked out of sight on the top shelf of my kitchen cabinet. The raised black letters on the canister identified the contents as flour. If a friend happened to spy the leftovers in my fridge, I would lie, saying that it was couscous. I once spent a weekend alone in New York City. I rode the subway, hailed a cab, wandered Central Park without police protection. I've been known to dine out by myself. I learned to stop asking for sweet tea. I grew tired of the dismissive waiter saying, "The sugar is on the table," and me trying to explain, "It's simply not the same." I paid scant attention to football, claiming not to know that the Florida State Seminoles were anything other than an amalgam of lost tribes chased into the Everglades by the U.S. Army and disease. I owned an ice scraper. I pretended to like, even understand, Philip Glass. I never ate supper anymore. Dinner. Let's go have dinner. I joined the ACLU. But there is one fact above all others that illustrates how far I had traveled from Iris Haven and my deep South roots. My fiancé, the man who dumped me 2 weeks before we were to say our vows in a Unitarian chapel close to campus, hailed from Nigeria. Ahmed Al-Kuwaiti. His was a lilting London-influenced perfect grammar accent. A Muslim by birth, training, and choice, he considered my Catholic upbringing exotic, naive. He was, as my southern cronies would say, black as the ace of spades.
Connie Mae Fowler reading from her book, The Problem with Murmur Lee. That is the voice of Charlie Mudd there. Is channeled through Connie Mae Fowler. Lovely. That brings us to another issue. As we mentioned, Charlie is this ex-divinity student, and faith turns up here. We have Ahmed, who is was her fiancé until she realized that, indeed, he had another wife. And we have Murmur Lee and Charlie growing up Catholic.
Yes.
Murmur Lee's mother, very Catholic. Mm-hmm. And you said your own mom was a nun. What part of their Catholicism was the hardest for them to let go of?
I think probably notions of grace and forgiveness. And I think they also both really loved the ritual. And I think that for Murmur, it was particularly difficult never to be able to hear plain song again. I think that she really loved it.
Mm-hmm. You were raised Catholic?
Yes.
Yeah. How important is religion to the story?
I think it's terribly important. I think that a lot of my books really deal with how do we retain any sense of the spiritual in this technologically driven society we're in. And they usually figure out ways to do it, but they usually leave organized religion on their way to a new understanding.
Mm-hmm. Although it could be argued that music, at least, is more important to the plot
than
religion
doubt.
Is. And at some point, people are thinking that Murmur may be seeing visions. And, you know, you write in a way that she does, she thinks she is, but it's something that's brought on by these seizures that
yes.
has a scientific and a musical explanation.
Yeah, the local priest in town and her mother are hoping that she is, you know, a vision-seeing saint, and the town goes crazy for a little while, but alas, she's just got epilepsy.
Well, you seem to go back to the well of writing about rural Florida a lot. Do you think you'll always do that?
No. I love rural Florida. I identify it as the real Florida, and the Florida that is slipping out of our grasp very quickly. But I'm branching out. Even this book is a new direction for me. So many of my books were kind of stemmed from my childhood, and this one doesn't at all. And I'm working on a novel now that's loosely inspired by the life of blues legend Memphis Minnie. So I don't think it'll have any Florida connection at all. So that'll be a first.
And tell me about Memphis Minnie.
Memphis Minnie is this fantastic blues woman who was born in Algiers, Louisiana in 1897. When she was 7 years old, someone put a guitar in her hands, and she never looked back. She ran away to Beale Street, learned how to play the blues like nobody's business, then joined the circus, and in the 1920s and 30s was playing blues for the circus, and then joined the migration up to Chicago. And there's lots of anecdotal evidence that she probably electrified the blues 4 years before Muddy Waters did.
But doesn't get the credit?
Doesn't get the credit.
Why is that, do you think?
She's a female.
Now, in your book, there's a scene that I two scenes, because we're hearing it first from Murmur's point of view and then from her boyfriend's point of view about their first time together.
Yes.
And if you were to go with one, it's just well written. You hear real depth in both of those characters, but they have two different views of what turning points were. And she's almost resigned to, she likes being with him, but she's almost resigned to being with him, because she asks him a very important question after their first time together, and that is how he viewed his mother.
Yes, and he didn't love his mother at all, and she realized that. And it upsets her, but she goes ahead and kind of just deals with it and brushes it aside. But in death, as she's reflecting upon it, she really realizes what a mistake that was, and that she needed to find men who loved their mothers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. With your own conflicted childhood, I wonder, how did you ultimately love your mother?
Oh, I love my mother desperately, desperately. I think, you know, most children do. I think that there's something, a real disconnect when children stop loving their parent. I mean, my mother, you know, really, really battered us, but and called us horrible names and all that stuff. But I don't blame her. I mean, she had a horrible life, and I wanted to please her through every step of the way. I feel very sad for her, because she was a woman of great potential, and life sort of conspired against her so that she couldn't meet it. But no, I love her dearly.
Well, you say you don't blame her. I'm wondering if some people in the audience might hear that and recoil a bit, because you were
probably
a defenseless child.
Yeah, you know, probably. But and I sometimes, especially when I was on tour with before when Katie Wakes, some people would call in and they were angry at me that I, you know, had reached some level of forgiveness. It's almost as if Murmur says to her husband, you know, that she's not going to relieve him of the consequences. She has forgiven him, but mm-hmm. won't relieve him of the consequences, because the forgiveness is for me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not for her, it's for me, so that I can go on in a healthy way.
Well, Connie Mae Fowler, thanks for talking with us today.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Connie Mae Fowler's latest book is The Problem with Murmur Lee, and she'll be reading from more of the book tonight at 7 at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham. Bruce Molsky is a fiddle player and a guitarist, a banjoist, and a singer. He plays traditional Appalachian music with influences from the blues and the rhythms of West Africa. We're hearing some of Bruce Molsky right now on the fiddle. He's accompanied by Paul Brown of NPR News on the banjo. Bruce Molsky performs in the Triangle this weekend with renowned musician Tim O'Brien, who we'll be hearing from in just a moment. Bruce Molsky is with us now. Welcome to The State of Things, Bruce.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Hi. Well, your musical career, now steeped in Americana and traditional music, I understand it began with guitar lessons in the Bronx.
That's right. Actually, it began with the great jazz pianist and music educator Billy Taylor, who came to my public school in the Bronx when I was in the fifth grade and played music for all us kids. And I came home that day with this notion that maybe I could play a musical instrument. And I asked my mom for guitar lessons, and she sent me around the corner to the teacher.
Yeah, how did those guitar lessons go?
They lasted about a year, but the guitar, of course, lasted a lot longer. I think my teacher was a classical teacher, and I wasn't too keen on classical music, and he gave me a little bit of a background in folk music, and I think that's kind of what I took and went forward with. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe he had enough of me. I'm not sure.
So you went on to college at Cornell, and then after college, I understand, you moved south because it was the traditional music that you wanted to hear more of and learn more of. And one day you visited Tommy Jarrell, or in the famous fiddler who lived near Mount Airy here in North Carolina.
Yes, I was visiting another musician friend who lived in the same community as Tommy, his name was Steve Roberts. He's no longer, he doesn't live around there any longer. He's moved away. But I had come to visit Steve, and Steve dropped me off at Tommy's house, and I had met Tommy briefly one time before, and Steve was going to the grocery store to run some errands or something, and his car broke down, and Tommy didn't have a phone, and so Steve just kind of dropped out of sight for 5 or 6 or 7 hours, and I had a really, really wonderful day just playing music with Tommy and hearing stories, and I think it was probably the best music lesson I ever had.
Do you remember what you learned that day?
I learned how I came away realizing how little I knew about the fiddle. But I watched him and just tried to correlate what his hands were doing compared to what I was hearing, and I knew I had a lot of work in front of me.
Right. Well, you got a degree from Cornell, and you're a mechanical engineer.
Well, that's almost true. I did not get a degree from Cornell.
Okay.
I jumped around college a few times before I finally became an engineer through work experience.
Mm-hmm. So, but when did you decide to make the switch from being a mechanical engineer, you know, working on building construction, to making the switch to full-time musician?
Well, I left that career in about 8 years ago, and it was a process. I mean, I always played music, of course, for my own pleasure, and I'd been performing for many years on, you know, nights and weekends, and I had a wake up call. You know, I saw kind of middle age was right there on the horizon and getting closer, and I realized that I'd better start doing the things that I would regret not having done when I'm too old.
Okay.
And playing music full-time was one of them.
Wonderful. Well, we are talking with musician Bruce Malski. His latest CD is Contented Must Be, and he comes to the Triangle this weekend. Just ahead, we'll be talking with musician Tim O'Brien, who'll be playing with Bruce. We'll take your calls, 1-877-962-9862. All that ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and we're talking with musician Bruce Malski, who performs this weekend in the Triangle with Tim O'Brien. Now let's hear a tune that both Tim O'Brien and Bruce Malski have performed. It's credited to the famous North Carolina fiddler Tommy Jarrell of Round Peak. It's called The Drunkard's Hiccups. In this version, Tim O'Brien's providing vocals.
Going back to Carolina, gonna play my last game. Jack of Diamonds, Jack of Diamonds, I've known you.
And we continue our conversation with Bruce Malski and Tim O'Brien, who's on the phone from Newport, Tennessee. Thanks for talking with us, Tim O'Brien. Hi there. Well, The Drunkard's Hiccups, also known as Jack of Diamonds, you've added something to this song, wasn't in a version of the song by Bruce Malski. You refer to going back to Carolina. In Bruce Malski's version, it's Rhode Island. Well, first of all, Tim O'Brien, why'd you choose to sing about Carolina in that song?
Well, I guess I kind of got influenced by Tommy Jarrell, you know, and he's certainly from North Carolina, but also the record that we were making was related to the novel Cold Mountain. We did songs that were quoted from or actually mentioned in the novel by Charles Frazier. So North Carolina is, you know, if you're looking for a place name, that's the one.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And Bruce Malski, why'd you choose Rhode Island? Is that the original version of it, or was it?
I was just singing the words that Tommy sang. That's. I'm not sure if you ever even went to Rhode Island.
Well, good. Well, Tim O'Brien, you play so many kinds of music. How do you explain the difference between, say, bluegrass, old time, and country music? Is there an easy way to point out those differences?
Well, you know, it's kind of the way it's marketed, really. I'm outside the Walmart Supercenter, and I think they sell country music, but they probably don't sell very much old-time music inside. Bluegrass is kind of in between the two. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just handles, really. The names of the music are kind of handles you can carry them around with. They're also, I think they have to do with the kind of people that like the music. Bluegrass fans tend to think that they know something other people don't, you know. It's kind of an inside club, and I think...
What do they know something that other people don't? Or?
Well, they do. It's really exciting music. It's really demanding music. A lot of them are musicians themselves. and they appreciate what the people on stage are doing, and they play as much music themselves as at festivals, for instance, as the performers on the stage do. They're out in the parking lots. Now, with old time music, there's very little that goes on stage. There might be a contest, but it's more about just kind of getting together with your friends and playing. And they're certainly related in that way, and they share a lot of the same material. What used to be called country music was the same kind of stuff that you hear out in the fields at bluegrass festivals and old-time fiddlers conventions.
Mm-hmm. Now, your roots are in Colorado, Tim O'Brien, right?
I'm originally from West Virginia, Wheeling, and
okay.
I grew up there, and then I lived in Colorado for about 22 years, so I'm not sure where I'm from. I'm from Walmart Supercenter.
Okay, you're from Mountain Territory, nonetheless, right?
Yeah.
And you played rock music when you started playing guitar as a teenager.
Yeah, excuse me. I was under the spell of the Beatles, and certainly was also under the spell of stuff like Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Bob Dylan. And then where I grew up was kind of a country music capital. They had a good radio station there, and a Saturday night live program that would draw people from all over the area and national performers.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to hear a lot of country music, and Merle Haggard, Buck Owens, and saw Jerry Lee Lewis several times there.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I know you'll be playing this weekend with Bruce Mosky. Thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be on the air.
Okay.
Great to be with you all. I'm looking forward to getting to the Triangle again.
Okay.
My friends from that area. Several years I've been associated with Sugar Hill label, and they're still going strong right there in Durham.
Indeed. Okay. Well, thanks so much, Tim O'Brien.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Tim O'Brien talking to us from outside the Walmart Supercenter in Newport, Tennessee. Bruce Mosky, you grew up in New York, as we said, and your influences, there were a number of influences you had, right? When did you first hear the blues?
The blues was some of the first traditional music that I really ever heard. I can't even tell you how I came upon an LP of Mississippi John Hurt that he made right around the time he was rediscovered in his hometown in Avalon, Mississippi, and his music just really turned me on. You know, that alternating bass style of finger-picking guitars was really made a lot of us urban kids. It just turned us on and made us feel like, oh, hey, that's something that I could do, you know, to listen to him play the Spike Driver Blues, which is one of his classic pieces.
Mm-hmm.
It just made a lot of sense, and it really rung true. So that was, you know, I heard the blues when I was probably in my early teens, and it's really kind of underpinned everything that I do musically.
Right. And there are other influences that we hear in your music. African music. And we're talking here not African-American music, but music straight out of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
There's a song, I believe, it's from Zimbabwe recording. Is that right?
Something that I've recorded?
Yeah, Brothers
yes.
and Sisters. Yeah.
Oh, Brothers and Sisters, actually, I wrote.
Okay.
I wrote it in a West African guitar style, which is kind of a syncopated polyrhythmic guitar style. But that kind of way of playing guitar was, I first heard recordings of a man named Wenda Jean Bosco, who was a real legendary guitar player from the Congo. And he recorded this kind of guitar style where the thumb is playing bass notes that are rhythmically in opposition to the melody and has a particular kind of chord movement. It's very, very moving music, and it comes straight from the heart, and it also has a real direct connection with how we hear rhythm in American traditional and pop music. You know, it's all that kind of stuff brings the world a lot closer.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to some of this. This is Brothers and Sisters, Bruce Mosky, from his 2000 CD, Poor Man's Troubles.
Thank you.
That's Bruce Mulske, Brothers and Sisters, from his CD Poor Man's Troubles. And Bruce Mulske's on the line with us. He's going to be performing in the Triangle this weekend with Tim O'Brien. And this was inspired by a Zimbabwe National Choir tune?
Yes, that was. It was a really beautiful LP. I used to go into record stores in New York and just buy things that looked like they were interesting. And, you know, I got turned on to a lot of music just by taking a chance. You know, this was an LP made in the 1960s of a lot of African freedom songs.
Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't have even heard the record before you bought it. It was just judging it by the cover. This might be interesting to listen to.
Well, the cover had a picture of a beautiful African tribal woman in a sarong with a baby in one hand and a machine gun in the other. And it was a powerful photograph, and it was called Africa in Revolutionary Music. And I bought it for the cover.
Now, have you ever been to Africa?
No, I would love to go sometime. It's on the list.
Oh, yeah.
I've become a fan of, you know, Africa's 150 countries or something like that. There's no such thing as African music. There's music from Africa, but there's such a depth and breadth of styles and types of performance. And I mean, it's a lifetime of study, like anything.
Right. There is, of course, Zimbabwe in the middle part of Africa, but their West African rhythms have very much influenced American blues.
Yes.
And there's another sort of music you play. I understand it's called a crooked tune. What do you mean by crooked tune?
Oh gosh. Well, in you know, Southern American music, crooked tunes are something that, you know, it's kind of a comparative term. Most people are accustomed to hearing music that comes in 4-beat or 8-beat phrases, and crooked tunes are tunes that have odd counting phrases in them. You know, you might have you might have 3 notes followed by 5-note phrases. They can still be in the same time signature, you know, but they're tunes that just kind of, they weave around, and they're lyrical, and they sound to me a whole lot more like people speaking, because they're less constrained to having to count to 4.
Well, why don't we hear some? I think we have one of them here. This is called Jeff Sturgeon, Bruce Mulske performing here. That's Jeff Sturgeon, as performed by Bruce Mulske. What kind of bow style are you using there as you're playing fiddle, Bruce?
Well, I've come to the conclusion over the years that I'm just a frustrated percussionist, and I probably picked up the wrong instrument. But my bowing style comes from trying to underpin melody with real rhythmic kind of phrases. And, you know, the bow moves in circles, it moves back and forth, it moves up and down, it chops, it goes long, it goes short, anything I can to draw the rhythm out of the melody. And it's based in just dance music. I spent many years playing for dances.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned a moment ago that crooked tunes were almost like voices going, it sounds like a very fast-paced conversation to me.
That would have been more like an argument than a warm, loving conversation.
Indeed. So I want to get back to what you mentioned before our last break, and you were talking about how you'd been this mechanical engineer and just decided that you were going to make your career in music, and you were in your 40s by then.
I made the change when I was 40, yeah. Big birthday present.
Yeah. Yeah. Had that been a long time in coming? And is that a big leap to make?
Well, it was a huge leap to make. I mean, I did engineering work for 20 years. I mean, when you've done anything for a long, long time, it becomes a part of who you are. And so it's just kind of emotionally, it's a risk to just step away from something that's such a big part of your life and take a chance on something else. Mm-hmm. But I never had any regrets. I guess I just kind of figured I was well. One of the things that kind of enabled me was sitting in a taxi in Boston going to a show, and the taxi driver asked me what I did, and I said, "Well, I'm a musician. You can see my fiddle case." And we just got to talking, and he says my son and I had a trucking business for a while, and we decided to sell it and open this taxi cab business. He says, "You know, a man should be able to change his career every 15 years or so if he wants to." I thought, well, if he can do it, so can I.
Indeed. Do you find, does any of the work as a mechanical engineer overlap with what you're doing as a musician now?
Somewhat. In a loosest kind of sense, I was a project manager. I ran, I ran projects. And you have to have, I guess most of the skills are business-related skills. You know, deadlines, schedules, budgets, and things like that. I mean, you have to... Unfortunately, in order to create time to be creative, you have to control all that stuff. And so I'm glad I had some experience in the world of business, but I wouldn't say it contributes a whole lot directly to the music I play.
I had to ask, though, you know.
Yeah.
And finally, you're playing with Tim O'Brien this weekend in the Triangle. Do you play a lot together?
No, we've known each other for a long time, and I'm probably one of his biggest fans. We've played on the stage together a few times, in big concerts with a lot of people, but this is the first time we're just doing a show, the two of us. I'm very excited about it, and we're going to perform a few things together. Maybe we'll do that Drunkard's Hiccups, who knows?
Well, we hope so. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today, Bruce Malski. Thanks so much.
Hey, you're very, very welcome. I was happy to be here.
Okay. Tim O'Brien and Bruce Malski will be performing Saturday night at 8 at the Community Church Coffee House in Chapel Hill. Why don't we hear something here by Tim O'Brien and his band, a song called I've Endured. Tim O'Brien and the Ola Bell Reed song, I've Endured. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about the show, drop us an email, sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.